I want you to take a moment and imagine that you're in a foreign country where you don't know who to trust, and a lot of the people there either want you and your partners either hurt or killed. Now imagine you are there to protect America's interest in the region. And lastly, imagine for a moment, all hell breaks loose one day and you and your friends and other people that you know come under attack. My next guest is Mark Geist, otherwise known as Oz. He is a member of the Annex security team that fought the Battle of Benghazi in Libya from September 11th to September 12th, 2012. Mark finished his career as a security contractor in Benghazi, Libya, where he was credited with helping to save the lives of more than 25 Americans. Mr. Geist is still recovering from his injuries he sustained in this battle. He is the co-author of the best-selling book, 13 Hours, The Inside Account of What Really Happened in Benghazi, a book that later made it to the big screen and was a blockbuster hit. You do not want to miss this episode with Mark Geist, Oz, next on the Criminal Justice Evolution podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Welcome back to the CJ Evolution podcast. I am Patrick, your host and creator of this great show. If you're a first-time listener, welcome. We know you're going to love the content. Long-time listener, welcome back. Thanks again for all your support. A big shout-out to all the brave men and women working in the criminal justice field. Whatever you were doing, wherever you were at, thank you for doing it. It is a very tough environment, but remember this. You are honored, cherished, and above all, you are loved. Keep up the fantastic work. You know, it's such an honor to be partnered with a great company like Detectachem. They are helping keep our brave men and women safer by offering mobile threat detection that fits in the palm of their hands, detecting illicit drugs, explosives, now COVID-19. This application-based technology is a must-have for your organization. Head over to cjevolution.com and check out the link to Detectachem. If you love coffee, you're going to love the products from Four Sigmatic. Everything from coffees to elixirs to cocos, they have it all. My favorite coffee, it's got to be the Lion's Mane mushroom coffee. Yes, I said mushrooms, and it doesn't taste like mushrooms. I think it tastes better than regular coffee that I'm used to. Go to cjevolution.com, see the link to Four Sigmatic, and you're going to get 15% off of your purchases using the promo code CJEVO. On to this amazing show. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I'm very excited to have my next guest on the show. Mark Oz Geist is on. He was a former member of the Annex security team that fought the Battle of Benghazi in Libya, September 11th to September 12th, 2012. Who could forget that incident? He's also a former Marine and best-selling author of 13 Hours, The Inside Account of What Really Happened in Benghazi. Mark, welcome, sir. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here, man. I know you're busy, and we're both in Colorado. Beautiful day in Colorado right now.
It is.
Get rid of that snow. And you've done so much in your life, sir, and thank you for your service, by the way. I don't think I mentioned you were a law enforcement officer for many years. I always ask Leo's, you know, former military, why they went into the career of service to country, service to community. And you're no different, brother. Why did you decide to go that route and start serving?
You know, I think, I had a lot of family in the military on my mom's side, and my grandfather served in World War II. He was actually in North Africa. He's got the North Africa Campaign Medal, which most likely means that he served in Libya. So wow. We probably both chewed some of the same dust and same sand. I think he had 5 Purple Hearts, Silver Star, Bronze Star. I mean, he was really kind of my hero.
So that was in World War II, bro?
That was World War II.
Yeah, he probably fought like Rommel and shit like that, right?
Yeah, Rommel. I mean, he was, and then because he was in the, he didn't go in on Normandy, but mm-hmm. which most likely he was with Patton's army because that's who was over in North Africa. And then he went into Germany, or he was into France and after Normandy, and then they pushed all the way through to Germany, and he stayed. He's got he had the German occupation medal, so he stayed for afterwards. And then he came back. He worked in the intel services the latter part of his military career, and then he came back and was I think he got out of the army in at Fort Carson, and that's where my grandmother and him met. Wow. And they settled right here about 90 miles from Fort Carson, which is a little town called Ordway, which mm-hmm. is about 20 miles yeah. north of Rocky Ford, where I grew up.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's, you know, it's when we talk about, you know, the men and women who served in World War II. I mean, I just hope people never forget that generation. I know it's the greatest generation, but I think, you know, some people tend to forget the sacrifice. Everybody was, you know, in the war effort. Because, and I don't know if you see that anymore. I mean, I don't a lot. I don't know from your perspective, Mark, if you see that, but it truly was just everybody coming and supporting the war effort, everybody all in. And those were the true heroes. I mean, it's just amazing to me the sacrifice that they gave to this great country.
So, yeah, you know, and I think we saw a little bit of that at the beginning of 2001, you know, after the towers got hit. It really kind of solidified the country into the threat that was facing us. I mean, with the going into Afghanistan in 2001, and then even with going into Iraq. I mean, you know, there was a lot of after the fact people trying to decide which side the politics should lie on. But at that point, it was all about politics instead of why we really went there was for, you know, whether it was right or wrong. I mean, that's history will debate that forever. But we were all a solid country then, seemed like. We were all kind of on the same sheet of music that America needs to be first and we need to take care of us and protect those at home.
Yeah, and you're right. I talked to a lot of people that come on the show, and you're exactly right. I mean, that was a catalyst, you know, in 2001, where a lot of people heeded the call. I know a lot of SEALs that joined, you know, the Navy at that time that went and served. And you're right. I just, you know, I think we just quickly forget those times in history. I mean, with the way the world moves so quickly, I wish we would, you know, step back and kind of ponder that and reflect on that more often than we do. So you transition. You know, let's back up, brother. So you at some point went into the Marine Corps. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I knew one of two, I was going to do one of two things. It was either go into the military or I was going to work on some ranch being a cowboy. Yeah. I mean, I just loved that. Independence, I think, is what it was. But I was walking with one of my best friends lives up there in Denver near where you're at, Centennial area.
Yeah.
And just north of there. And it was like right after lunch and we're walking down the hall going to math class and he just keeps going. I'm like, where are you going? He said, I'm gonna go talk to the Marine Corps recruiter. And I'm like, really? I can get out of math class for that? He's like, yeah. I'm like, I'm with you, you know? So I went down and met with a Marine Corps recruiter. You know, I took the ASVAB and all that. And he's like, hey, you can do anything you want in the Marine Corps. What do you want? And you can figure out what I chose. I chose to be the infantry.
Yeah, of course. Well, everybody in the Marine Corps is an infantryman first, right? Rifleman
right.
first.
Yes, that is true. But I wanted to be in, I mean, I wanted to play soldier every day. I wanted to play
Marine
every day.
Yeah, you want to be in the shit.
I mean, jump out of airplanes, blow things up, shoot things. I mean, what better way to be an adult and still not have to grow up?
So you were in the Marine Corps for 12 years, right?
Yep, 12 years.
Okay. And then at some point, and thank you for your service, by the way, to the Marine Corps.
Thank you for yours as well.
Yeah, you're welcome. And then you transition out of the Marine Corps. You had a decorated career in the Marine Corps. You come out of the Marines. Then what?
I go to the only thing I know, and that's serving the people again, you know, and that's it's going into law enforcement. And my uncle had worked with the radio shop here in Colorado Springs. And so he knew a lot of the police officers, and one of them had left the police department in Colorado Springs, retired there, and took over as sheriff in Teller County, which is up on the backside of Pikes Peak. And I had done an interview with him, and they said, you know, we got a job for you if you can pass the academy, which I mean,
that'd be really hard.
Be very difficult. And I actually went to the police academy in Trinidad, down at Trinidad Junior College. And it was kind of an eye opener for me in a sense of, those that were coming in, or at least some of those that were wanting to come into the military or into law enforcement. But, it was,
What do you mean by that, Mark?
The way we do it here in Colorado Springs or in Colorado, I mean, a lot of, you don't have to have a job to go to the police academy. Technically, you can go in if you're doing a criminal justice program in the junior college or whatever, you can go get your certification if you're paying for it yourself. And then you kind of go shop yourself out to being a cop. Yeah. And, you know, at that point, no one, some of the people haven't taken the background tests or anything like that. So,
yeah,
you know, you get some people that are there for not necessarily all the right reasons, I think. At least that's my opinion.
No, I agree. I agree with that.
I really kind of wish that it would go back to the way it used to be, where if everybody that was going to be a police officer in Colorado went through Golden.
You know, I remember that. I remember that. State Patrol.
Yeah, State Patrol ran it, and it was more, I mean, you know, a lot of people, especially this time in what's going on in law enforcement or with law enforcement, would probably not like that, but it was more paramilitary in a sense. At least you had more discipline and more organization, and you knew everybody that was a law enforcement officer in Colorado was a set standard.
Yeah.
Which I like that. I like that.
Yeah. I remember you that, you know, yeah, I remember that really vividly now with, you know, up at Golden doing skills training, firearms, PPCT, yep, all that stuff with these two big, huge State Patrol guys, Piney and Hollywood. They were there, and I don't know if they're still there. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but they were these big, huge monster, you know, CSP trainers. And you're right. I mean, it was just a different time back then, and it was more paramilitary, which I was used to getting out of the Army. Right. And I agree. I don't know if you could get away with some of that, you know, I don't know, nowadays. So, but.
Well, I think, you know, honestly, I think it's the right way to go. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, it's because what we need in law enforcement, and we'll probably get to this a little bit more. I think we need more training.
Yeah.
For our law enforcement officers. We need more money and more training for it, not less.
Yeah. Agreed. Agreed. And there's one academy out there, Flat Rock, it's in Brighton, mm-hmm. that is really, I mean, it's different agencies that are, you know, send their sponsored people there. And that's paramilitary, because I remember we would send some of our people there. And, you know, I remember going down the halls, you know, the cadets would just get on the side of the walls and stuff. And it was yes, sir, no, sir, kind of stuff. I was like, wow. Yeah. I like this.
Yeah. And I think that's what it's missing is that conformity to a standard and to a uniform standard across the state.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So you did time at the sheriff's department, and then you went to the police department, and you rose to the rank of chief of police, the man, number one.
Well, I interviewed for the job.
And you interviewed for the job.
Yeah. They were looking for a new chief. They were kind of wanting, you know, and anybody that's here in Colorado knows, probably
everybody. If
you've been here anywhere, any amount of time, you know of Fowler. Fowler used to be like the speed trap capital of the state. And I mean, there actually sits a semi trailer on the outskirts of town. I think it's still there. It says, watch your speed.
I remember.
I mean, because that's what they were known for.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of small towns like that in across the states that, you know, that's they use revenue. Law enforcement for a ticket revenue
or
for
revenue.
A revenue process. And I that's not me. I told them straight up that one, I don't like running traffic, period, because as a cop, I think you're very vulnerable, because usually you're sitting in a car and you're in a place where you have blind spots around your car and you're focused on traffic and not your surroundings all the time. And part of that's because, you know, right before I got on with Teller County, there was a deputy up there that got ambushed and killed because he was sitting in his police car. Mm-hmm. And so that was just one of those things that my pet peeve is if I was going to run traffic, I usually try to stand outside my car so I can hear everything around me.
Yeah, that's a good point. We used to do that. We used to, you know, do it in tandem. I remember when I was a young officer, we used to have one guy out there with the radar, the LIDAR, and then another guy, you know, outside, like you said, so you're more observant of your surroundings. And then, you know, another guy down, whatever, you know, quarter mile, half a mile down, that would do all the catching, you know, that go after the speeder. So yeah, that's a great point. You know, I mean, getting out of your car, I mean, there's no reason not to.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, a lot of people don't like doing it because they got to get, you're going to get cold if it's in the wintertime or something like that. I mean, you know what? Cold's better than dead.
Yeah, exactly. And you brought up a good point, Mark. I mean, you know, thank God it's not the norm where, you know, cops have been ambushed recently, in New York City, a year or two ago. And these two poor cops are sitting in their patrol car. I think it was during the winter. They get ambushed by some idiot, comes up and shoots them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just a crazy.
It's a very dangerous spot to be, in a parked police car.
Yeah. Yeah. And I used to tell people, look, I mean, when I was a supervisor on the street, look, if you're tired, fucking go back to the police department. I'd rather have you go back, walk around, or get out of the car, walk around, or come back, take a cat nap for 15 minutes, get up, maybe get refreshed, and then get back in the car. Don't fall asleep in the car. And I remember as a young officer, we had a supervisor, we had a game called I'm not going to say his name, but find the certain sergeant that was, he would go around and sleep. What was wrong?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
What the hell is wrong with you? I mean, I was too paranoid, thank God. I'd rather be, like you said, I'd rather be alive than dead. I don't want some idiot sneaking up on me.
Yeah, and you just never know. I mean, you know, and that's the unfortunate thing is, you know, those are the guys that we call ROD.
Yeah, RODs.
Yeah, RODs, retired on duty.
Yeah, I remember that, so... You spend a lot of time in law enforcement, Mark. You see what's going on in the news with this war on law enforcement, for lack of a better word.
The Senate just passed, I think it was the Senate bill or the House, one of the two at the Fed level, their new law, the George Floyd, or they're trying to get through the House, the George Floyd law enforcement bill. And I haven't read the whole thing, so I'm not going to be too overcritical of it until I have, but I know that, you know, the rhetoric that's out there about defunding police and taking away their powers, I think is just it's the wrong avenue to go down. What we should be doing is we should be standing up for our law enforcement officers. I mean, most people, I don't think even realize what a cop goes through every day, you know, and you being military, both of us being military and also law enforcement. I mean, you know, we have as a country done phenomenal for our veterans. Mm-hmm. You know, as in supporting them and trying to get into the PTS problems and addressing those things, at least from a support standpoint, even though the VA needs to work on that a little bit. But the ones that we failed is our law enforcement officers. I mean, I think back, I was listening to a song by George Strait, and it's called The Weight of the Badge.
Mm-hmm.
And, he just talks about what that little badge means and what it weighs on a person who's there for the right reasons. And I think 99.9% of cops are there for the right reason. It's that selfless service.
Yeah.
But, every day, most law enforcement officers are dealing with the worst parts of society and seeing the bad things, whether it be a suicide. You know, I think back to some of the things. I mean, I came upon a traffic accident that, it was a rollover. There was a 9-year-old kid trapped in the back. The mother had gotten crushed by the car as it rolled over, and there was a brain right there in the middle of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And to get that girl out so she didn't have to look at her mother that was dead and go through that. And then, you know, everything else. I mean, you have a shooting downtown Denver and you go try to find witnesses and no one wants to testify. No one wants to step up. But then they complain that cops aren't doing enough. And then that cop has to take that home and then take the badge off, take the gun belt off, and then drop that at the door when they walk in the house because they've got a family that really depends on them to not bring that stuff home. And they do that every day, 365 days a year. Yeah. I mean, for 15, 20, 30 years. And that weighs on guys. And I don't think the majority of the country even realize what cops deal with on a day-to-day basis.
No, they don't. They see what's on the TV, they see what's on the movies, and they say, well, these guys don't do shit. They don't have to deal with much. It's all just driving around, kicking in doors with SWAT gear on. Yep. And you make a great point. The majority of people out there have no idea what cops deal with on a daily basis. And I tell cops or people I talk to, Mark, and try to educate the public, look, I don't care how tough somebody thinks they are. I got out of the military. I was like, I'm big and bad and all this other stuff. I can go handle police work. I'm going to just keep it down with all the stuff I've seen. I don't care how tough you are. It will get to you. There's only so much death and suffering, you know, that you can see before that stuff bubbles up and manifests somehow.
Yeah.
And you're exactly right. You bring it home. And that was probably the reason why I got divorced after 20 years when I was still in law enforcement. I take responsibility for that. I always talk about that. That was my bad. I was really good at stuffing it down.
Yeah.
And not talking about it, because you know as well as I do, brother, when you start talking about that stuff, at least from what I saw in my life and my career, well, that's a sign of weakness.
Yeah.
Now, you can't talk about that.
Well, and you're gonna get a desk job.
Yeah.
I was actually on a kind of a focus group, I guess, talking about a little bit of some of these same things. And it was a gentleman on there. He was a football player, and he was talking about his different experiences with cops, and some of them were bad. And, you know, and for the cops out there that are screwing stuff up for the rest of us, that are doing the bad things, I mean, I hold no love for them, and I don't back them at all. I mean, you know what? And I think the majority of cops are doing that as well. I mean, there's no condoning of illegal and inappropriate actions. But you also can't judge a person by a 45-second snippet of video that's taken either. So I think in general, we all have to hold our opinions until we know the full of everything that's going on.
Exactly.
And I do think that the police or the people out there, the people that we serve, I mean, they have to hold us accountable. That's appropriate. I mean, you know, do I like it? Sometimes if we are, no, but that's just part of life, is you got to be held accountable. But ultimately, I think most law enforcement officers are there for the right reasons, and they want to help the people. And we got to help them do that as well. And I think that's where this whole thing about defunding police and, you know, and all of those things are just, is not the right way. It's let's get them more training. I mean, look at most police officers. How many times did you have to fire your gun for qualification a year?
Yeah. Yeah. We were lucky. We did it four times a year, which is a lot. Plus we did other kind of tactical training.
So right.
The department was really good about that, but I understand where you're going with this. Some departments don't.
They just can't afford it.
I mean, afford it.
You know, with budget cuts, what's the first thing that goes in law enforcement?
Training.
Yeah, you know what? Because you know what? Those that are the elected officials or the appointed officials, the chiefs and the majors and the captains, you know what? They've got to have the guys on the streets, because it's the stats that are what politicians want to look at and see that, oh, we drop crime by 10%. Well, okay, how did you do that, and was it effective? And we just got to look at things. I think we do need to look at things a little bit different, but I don't think it has anything to do with defunding them. No. Or what Colorado last year really kind of think screwed over all of our cops, and we allowed qualified immunity to be mitigated to almost nothing. I mean, so cops got to second guess everything they're doing. And if they do, you almost have to have insurance like doctors for malpractice insurance, basically. And who's going to pay for that?
Well, and who's going to
pay for that as a cop?
Thank God there's still people getting into it, brave men and women still getting into law enforcement.
Yes.
But we keep going down this road. I mean, it's already hard enough, as you probably know, with recruitment to law enforcement. Now with chipping away at qualified immunity, I'm glad you brought that up, which is protection for an officer. Not for an officer out there doing malicious stuff and illegal stuff, that there's no protection. But if somebody acts in good faith, there is qualified immunity, and we're chipping it away. What cop is going to want to get into it?
Oh, I know it, you know, and it's just absolutely ridiculous. And I'm sure here in Colorado, you're going to see it in session at the state house coming up this session.
Yeah.
You know, and.
Yeah, it's just, and defund the police, you know, I mean, here's the thing that I think some people don't understand. For people like you and me, okay, we're doing okay. You know, we got some, you know, we live in probably a nice area and stuff. I mean, okay. The people that really, if you know, the defund the police effects are the people that really need it.
Right.
I have a daughter that lives in Chicago, and believe it or not, depending on besides what the politicians are saying, the people that need the cops the most are in the areas, and they're saying, where are the cops?
Right.
South side of Chicago. There's no cops. And those are the ones that really need the cops, that want the cops.
Right.
You know, those are what really, not the people with private security details. The politicians, they don't care. They got security details. The ones that are making all the rules, it's the people that really need law enforcement that are going to suffer.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, I was down in Houston talking to a group of people, and I asked them, you know, it was a very diverse group of probably 15, 20 people, and I asked them, you know, hey, in the last week, has anybody here had any contact with cops outside of maybe a traffic stop? None of them had. I mean, how about in the last month? None of them. How about in the last year? None of them. It wasn't until I got to the last 10 years that maybe two of them had had contact with law enforcement other than a traffic stop. And most of them never even had a traffic stop. Mm-hmm. And they were some of those that were kind of, it wasn't they were wanting to defund it, but they were talking about that question and about qualified immunity. And that's when I came up with the thing of telling them, I'm like, let me tell you, a cop comes on duty and has minimum 3 to 4 calls waiting for him, mm-hmm. because those are those low priority calls of somebody that either had a, you know, it was somebody ran across their yard or there was a party and loud music, mm-hmm. or, you know, those things that aren't I mean, not that they're not significant, but they're not priority because there's no life or limb. You know, and then by the time they get done with a shift 10 hours later, a lot of times those 4 calls are still there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we want to defund police so that we can even make that worse. I mean, it makes no sense to me. None whatsoever.
Well, you saw,
it's a political thing.
Well, you saw what happened in New York City. I mean, maybe where they took away that 600 man undercover unit,
right?
With NYPD plainclothes cops. And you mm-hmm. see what happened, you know, and other things, but the result, the outcome of that was, okay, crime is going through the roof.
Right.
So, you know, right. It's causing, you know, it's there for every action, there's a reaction, right?
Yeah,
it's crazy. And I tell people, Mark, I mean, in my opinion, I don't think no cop, maybe there's a few that gets up in the morning, kisses their wife goodbye and says, you know what, I'm going to go out there and shoot somebody. I'm going to put everything on the line. I'm going to put my house, my career, my reputation, the threat of going to jail or prison. I'm going to just roll the dice. I'm going to go out there and shoot somebody.
Yeah, they don't want to do that. They don't want to do that. I mean, you know, and I think that's where, you know, if that does happen, I think that is a mental health issue because of the number. I mean, you look at the George Floyd thing. That guy's been that officer had, if you go back and look at his training,
oh,
I would love
problem.
To see his training file. I would love to see his incident file, what he's had to deal with over the last, 10, 15, 20 years that he'd been on. And I would also like to see how many people have ever stood up and asked him, hey, how you doing?
Yeah.
You know,
that's a good point.
Probably not.
I would bet you very little to none.
Right. And that doesn't, and I'm not saying that to condone what he did, mm-hmm. but we need to understand what sometimes causes those excess use of force issues. And we need to mitigate that ahead of time instead of waiting and trying to prosecute it or mitigate it after the fact, because after the fact, there's another person. I mean, because think about it. Now that's George Floyd's family that's gone and has to go through all the pain and anguish of what happened there, and the cops and the other 2 or 3 officers that were with him. You know, mm-hmm. Those families and all of those officers and all of those people involved have been affected by this, which could have been done if we would have done more training and more training on safety, on all of the factors that need to be done. I mean, and they want to take that away. That's what bothers me.
Well, I think it was a breakdown in leadership at all levels.
Yep.
You know, in that organization. And again, it's, you know, I think a lot of organizations suffer with that lack of leadership. What would you, so you were a senior executive in law enforcement, Mark, what advice would you give in the wake of all this stuff that's going on in the world? I mean, there's many things to talk about this, with challenges with law enforcement. But to leadership out there, what advice would you give them?
Well, I think one of the problems that we've seen, that I see across the board in all businesses, not just law enforcement, mm-hmm. is we don't teach leadership. Our colleges and universities and a lot of these programs, these training things, they teach management. Mm-hmm. And good you point, being yeah. in the military, understand a big difference between leadership and management. Management is about yourself or moving up, and leadership is about all of those that work for you. Mm-hmm. If you're putting those that work for you first, that's where leadership comes in. I mean, you know, having honor, courage, knowledge, loyalty, you know, endurance, all of those, you know, your initiative, your integrity, all of those things are not necessarily taught as a entity. It's about, okay, you got to get this thing filed to get up to be a captain. You got to go. I mean, one, we want you to have a 4-year degree to be a cop anymore. Then you got to be, have your master's to get into leadership, or at least up into there. Well, they don't teach leadership. They're teaching about management
and
how
theory
to
theory and yeah.
Yeah. Theory and process and all of that. When we forget that the guys on the street are the ones that make things happen and protect us. And we need to teach, we got to have the integrity and to hold each other accountable, but to also have the integrity and loyalty to those that we serve as well.
I love that. Very good advice. So let's pivot a little bit, brother. So you have a successful career in the Marine Corps. You have a successful law enforcement career. Now, what was next for Mark? You get out of law enforcement and then something was calling you. What was it?
Well, you know, for a brief period, and I don't know if I would qualify that I had a successful career in law enforcement. I believe I did, but one of the reasons I ended up leaving Fowler was me and I believe that law enforcement had to be fair across the board. Mm-hmm. And I didn't care what your status was, if you were a councilman or not. And I got to be.
Got to be careful.
Yeah. You know,
I think I know where you're going.
I was asked to overlook something and I wouldn't. Yeah. And that didn't go well. So I chose to leave and I started doing private investigations and bounty hunting for a very brief short time up in Pueblo, Colorado. And then, you know, with the war going on and trying to get back into that, I just felt that sense of service again, because, you know, doing what private investigations and the private side of that just isn't that cup of tea for me. I've got to be a part of something bigger than myself. And I just knew I had to get back into serving this country. And I did it the easiest way I could, was as a private security contractor.
Mm-hmm. And you end up in, well, first of all, I think you know, standing up to what you believe is right, brother, and I know you're a man of integrity. I think that's a success, because a lot of people, you know, would not do that. They would say, getting back to that conflict that you had to deal with, I think, you know, based on what you told me, that was the right thing to do. And you left on a high note because you didn't compromise your morals. You didn't compromise what was right.
Yeah. And I do understand that. And I feel the same way, but you know, I know the politician side of it, probably the people out there probably, you know, you should have done something to save your job. I mean, you know what? Sometimes there's bigger things than a job.
I was going to say, there's a higher calling, which you did.
Yeah.
And you got into contracting and you ended up in Benghazi, Libya.
Yeah, it was, well, I started out in Iraq and Afghanistan and a few other countries that end in Stan. But yeah, I ended up in Benghazi on September 11th, 2012.
And before that, I was just reading, you were the personal security detail of the prime minister of Iraq for a while.
And I was his security advisor.
Advisor.
Yeah, and we oversaw his security team and ensured when he traveled both international and with it through in and throughout Iraq, we made sure that all the bases were covered. He was one of the former prime ministers. It was Dr. Iyad Alawi. And, you know, he was actually elected back to run the country, but could never put together a government the way they do it. Oh, you know, kind of the whole the way they do it over there with a ministry kind of thing. But
Before we get into Benghazi, we all know, you know, it sparked the blockbuster movie 13 Hours. What's the life of a contractor? You know, I mean, and maybe that's too broad of a question, but what's a typical day look like when you were doing it, Mark?
When we talk about military contractors or private military contractors, I mean, they have been historically, they've been in almost every war, if not in every war that America's ever fought, even in the Revolutionary War. If we all remember our history, President George Washington, then General George Washington hired a couple other people, a general out of France, and then another one, I think, out of Belgium or something, to train the troops. Really the first private military contractor. But as a security contractor, my job started out, I was working on a group that protected State Department personnel. Did that for about 8 months, and then went to training Iraqi SWAT teams and Iraqi emergency response units, which then led into getting the job with as the security advisor for Dr. Ayad Alawi. And, you know, your average day, depending on what it is, you know, when I was training Iraqis, is starting the day at sunrise, usually a little bit before that, because we'd go hit the gym, get some breakfast, be on the range early or in the classroom, teaching Iraqis what they needed to do to run their own country, to be a qualified and quantified police force, their SWAT teams, what they can do and can't do, everything from, you know, their use of force to their hygiene to, I mean, everything that they needed to do to be operating as a unit. And you had to be on your toes because not all of them like this. I mean, they were there for the job, for the paycheck, and not necessarily for the service to their country.
Yeah. Head on a swivel, like you said. I mean, I imagine, you know, in a in a foreign country. So you end up in Benghazi. When you got to Libya, Mark, was I know just based on what I researched and just through history, I mean, it was stable, but it wasn't unstable. There's a lot of different factions that were happening in the country, right? I mean, a lot of different gangs, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah,
you know, that were in control of maybe like the docks and stuff like that, and there were people, you know, tribes that were in control of like what happened on the land, right? Airport was a big one too, coming in and out. So it was a lot of that stuff, right?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, you know, and there in Benghazi now, and you got to understand, everybody out there has to understand, when we think of Libya as a whole, it was still very tribal. I mean, the Gaddafi was what part of a certain tribe that can, and that tribe was the bigger tribe that controlled Tripoli and almost all the way down to halfway in, you know, halfway down, almost all the way, probably 2/3 of the country. Then you had Benghazi and Sirte, and then to the east, you still are to the east, you had Derna, and then you had the Egyptian border. And that was, that area was controlled by a complete different group. That was opposed to Gaddafi, which is part of why the whole thing came about anyways. And there was roughly 10 to 12 different militias that were in that area, the greater area of that Benghazi and Derna, training foreign fighters and Libyans that were part of it, but mostly foreign fighters, to go kill Americans in Afghanistan and Iraq. And really that's why Libya or why Gaddafi started attacking that, is because somebody from our government before Obama, George Bush, had told them that, you know what, you're either with us or you're against us. And if you're against us and you're not going to go after those people that are training people to kill Americans, then you're going to be next after what happened to Saddam Hussein. And so he got on board and started going after them, which, I mean, he did it in Gaddafi fashion and was going to annihilate them all, which then with our change in administrations, they addressed it differently under the Obama administration. And that's when we heard about the Arab Spring and all of that. So, I mean, it's like what most people don't understand. It's not as simple as just, okay, Gaddafi was killed and it was great. There was really nothing there that took over things. I mean, it was all ran by militias.
And I imagine the majority of people in the country, the natives of the country, they just wanted to live a normal life. They probably worried about the same shit we worry about, getting our kids to school, you know, living life, right?
Yeah, you know, and in all the countries I think I've been in, I mean, the average person is not caught up in the politics of things. Is not, I mean, they want, like you said, I mean, great analogy. I mean, they want to make a dollar. They don't want the government taking 2/3 of it. They want to have a roof over their head, running water, some decent sewage, you know, money to buy enough food to feed the kids and get the kids to school, get them educated and get them home without getting blown up by some IED or some drive-by shooting or whatever the case is.
Yeah. So you're in country, you're in Libya. I mean, how long was it, Mark, before you, from the time you got there, where shit just started going downhill, degrading? Was it a gradual or was it all at once?
You know, it was gradual because there had been a couple things that happened right before I got there. I'd only been there about 45 days, you know, and a few weeks, maybe a month before. I don't know the exact time frame, but, you know, there had been an IED placed over at the consulate or special mission facility, whichever way you want to call it, that blew up and blew a hole in the wall. You know, I think a couple weeks before I got there, another incident was the Brits' foreign service officer had gotten shot at with an RPG. Luckily they, I mean, luckily for them, the Lord must have been looking out for him, because the RPG went through the vehicle, injured one guy, but it didn't blow up, which is amazing in its own sense, because that's a tank killer and, you know, should have killed them all. But it was just gradually going downhill. And then, you know, but there have been other countries I've been in that I felt even more unsafe than Libya. And because the average person there really liked the Americans, liked what we had done to get rid of Gaddafi, which goes back to what we were just talking about, because the different tribes, and it actually made their life better to get rid of Gaddafi.
Mm-hmm.
But.
And so at one point did Ambassador Stevens get to Libya?
Well, he'd already been in Libya, but he was up at the embassy in Tripoli. That's where he spent most of his time. But he would come down periodically to the consulate and meet with different factions and with different other, you know, country council, you know, their consuliers or their people. Like that night, I think on September 11th, he was meeting with the Turkish emissary. And I mean, people always ask me, well, what were they meeting on? I'm like, I'm security guy for the CIA. I don't know. I have any idea what the State Department was doing, but you know, it's unfortunately he came down, and the only thing I knew about it was a couple weeks, about a week or so before, the team leader for the ambassador's security detail was in Benghazi. And he asked me what, you know, hey, what do you think I should, how should we run things? You know, should it be high profile or low profile? He was thinking low profile, and I'm like, how's he getting here? And he's like, he's flying. I'm like, is he flying commercial? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, well, everybody's going to know he's here once he gets on the plane in Tripoli. So I would ask the State Department to bring in as many people as possible, up your security, up your profile, because what you want to do then is just use that as a deterrent to keep them, to keep those that may want to get out of hand, keep them at bay.
Because usually there's a contingent of Marines, right? Active duty Marines at the embassy, right?
Well, and there is, there was up in Tripoli, but at the consulate there wasn't. And and that's one of the misnomers, is really the Marine detachment at an embassy or a consulate are there to protect classified material.
Oh, okay.
That's their primary purpose. And I mean, and it's, you know, a lot of people don't like to hear this or don't like it to be said, but there's other countries I've been in when the consulate or something like that starts to get attacked. And if you don't get in the doors, when they tell you to get in the doors, they shut them and lock them, because they are going to, it's much easier to sacrifice a life than sacrifice a lot of lives because of the classified material getting caught up and getting released.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it makes sense to me. I mean, I mean, but I could see what you said about a lot of people probably wouldn't, you know, understand that. So, shit hits the fan.
Yeah.
An all-out assault where you were at. I believe there was a Tonto, Army Ranger, that was involved. There was a couple SEALs, right? How many people were in this? I know it's in the movie, but for people who haven't seen the movie, and by the way, if you haven't seen 13 Hours, the real heroes of Benghazi, such as Mark Geis and others, need to check it out. Great movie. But how many people were on, you know, fighting, you know, and fighting back that surge of, you know, people that were coming to kill you guys and kill everybody?
We had six guys on our team. The ambassador had five guys on his team over at the consulate. But the difference is the consulate was about 8 acres and our facility was about the size of a football field. I was out with a female case officer, what I call a dinner date. Meeting with a local Libyan couple. And that's when I got a phone call from Tyrone. Tyrone is a former Navy SEAL, 20 years in the teams. Him and Jack were the Navy SEALs on our team. Glenn Doherty, who was also, his call sign was Bub, was the team leader for contractors up in Tripoli. But so he wasn't down there yet. Ty called me and said, hey, you need to get back to the annex, stay away from the consulate. And so I had to gather up the female case officer, got her in the vehicle, headed out the door. And that's when we got out of that compound where we were at and turned on the our encrypted comms and heard what's going on. And, you know, it was Well, we heard his gunfire, explosions, RPGs, belt-fed machine guns, and heard the cry. I don't want to say cries for help, but the reaching out for help from the State Department security team, that they were, if we didn't get there soon, they were going to all die. And so I had to get her back to the annex. And that's when the rest of the team, you know, after two times of being told not to go, when they heard the same thing that we heard, they just left on their own, because, you know, and a lot of that is our just way of thinking is, you know, if you can make a difference in somebody's life and you don't, what's worse than that? Not much. I mean, so we do whatever we can to save lives. And that's what they did, is they left to get over there to do what they can to save lives, to get their eyes on target and evaluate the scene and, you know, kind of assess what's going on and then take appropriate action.
Yeah. And you were severely injured, brother. I mean, you were shot multiple times.
You know, I was blown up three times.
I was going to say, you were blown up. You were shot. How many times? How many? I remember hearing about it when you gave a speech years ago when I listened to you. But how many times were you actually shot? You took rounds.
Well, most of all my injuries were from the mortars, from the shrapnel. Okay. I had 381 millimeter mortars. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning after we'd already repelled two other assaults on the annex. Mm-hmm. This is after everyone got back from what happened over at the embassy. They got back to the annex. We'd gotten attacked twice. I had moved from one position, got up on the roof. I was up with Ty, and we'd been talking about our kids and just about how well everybody had done that night and how everything had went so far, thinking that, you know, with what we were facing and having no air support or anything like that, we're a bunch of lucky people at this point. And if we can get onto daylight, things will be looking pretty good. But Glenn's team had just, you know, they had landed and been able to finally make their way to us, and they'd gotten there, and Glenn came up on the rooftop while the rest of the team went inside our CP, our command center, which is what we were on top of. And that's when 381 millimeter mortars landed. They opened up with RPGs as well, and belt fed machine guns and AK-47s. And the three rounds that hit the rooftop, there was a fourth one. The first one actually hit the wall, injured Dave. He was a State Department security guard up on top of the roof with us. The other three injured myself, injured Dave, and killed Ty and Glenn. Ended up, I think I had about 20, somewhere between 20 and 25 holes in me from shrapnel. My arm was almost severed off. As my wife says, she thought my head was about severed when she first saw me in the hospital. And that was like the 16th of September. You know, it was 10 days after Benghazi. So it was around the 16th of September, 5 to 6 days later, that looked like I had my head severed off. I had a 3-inch gash in my neck, holes up and down my chest and my back and my arms and legs. And so,
and you're still recovering from injuries that you sustained, right?
Yeah, they're going to be with me always. Yeah. I mean, I've got nerve damage in my left hand. It's never going to be the same. I mean, hearing loss, traumatic brain injury. I still have metal in my chest, although, you know, it's just part of that service though.
Yeah.
You know, we kind of all understand that there's going to be there is a sacrifice a lot of times that comes with playing around and like we always do.
Well, and the thing, let me ask you this, Mark, I mean, we had assets in the area, right? I mean, there were assets, military assets in the area. And, you know, was that an accurate portrayal? Pretty much as accurate, I imagine, as you can get in a movie with 13 hours where, you know, and I've watched that movie so many times, where they said, I called, you know, I think it was a female CIA analyst that called for, you know, backup, and it never came. That's true, right?
It is. You know, and it's something that a lot of people don't want to
admit. Well, I think two Delta guys came, right?
They did. There was two Delta guys that came down with Glenn's team. As part of his team, they came in and helped out. But, you know, we're in the Middle East. I mean, there's assets all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, it's the politics.
Yeah, I was going to say,
You know, and me as a warrior, I mean, I knew why I was there. I knew that as a private security contractor, I mean, I'm kind of like the lowest on the totem pole. I mean, there's a reason why they hire, especially the agency, you know, that's, they use us for a reason. You know, and I'm not condemning them for that. I took the job knowing that.
Yeah.
you know, and I probably looked at it a little bit different than some of the other guys, but, you know, it is what it is. But what really got me, and I know really got the other guys, is the fact that we had an ambassador missing. And, you know, if you don't want to send help for me, that's fine. I took the job understanding that, but why in the hell did you just send help for an ambassador? He's a direct representative of the president of the United States. And something should have been done more for that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, brother. What advice? And again, I can't even imagine what you went through, brother. Thanks again for your service, for sharing that again. I don't know if it's hard for you every time you talk about it, but I appreciate you sharing it. And at what point did you and your team get approached and say, hey, we want to make this into a movie? It's an incredible story. How did the movie, you know, come to fruition?
You know, it was kind of interesting is I had actually gotten contacted by a guy who was a former Navy SEAL that I had worked with for a while, who had a friend of a friend that was in Hollywood and wanted to do a movie. And, you know, the other guys were working still. They would all went back to work. I was the only one that couldn't. And they had approached me about doing a movie about my whole life, doing a biography kind of thing. And I'd looked into it. I'm actually got to sit down and talk with Clint Eastwood about it. And he asked me, he says, have you written a book? And I'm like, no. He said, well, you need to go write a book. So
and you did.
I started looking at doing one by myself. But before I signed the contract, I went to the other guys, and because I thought it would be a better story told by all of us.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I could only tell from my perspective where I was at and what I was doing and what I've been told they were doing, but it's not as effective as if I would have had their first count. So we all decided that it would be a better story to be told as a whole. And because the one story that wasn't getting told through all the politics and all this was what happened on the ground, the truth of what really happened, how we lived it, you know, at least. And we felt that's an obligation to be told, not only just for then, but more so for history, because it's written in a book and it's been made into a major motion picture that was very successful. And no matter what you want to say about it, the future is going to know what really happened. What happens with Americans when we get faced with hardships is we come together as a group. Doesn't matter what our race, color, creed, anything is, that we're Americans and we're going to fight for each other. And that's what, I mean, it happens all over the world.
Yeah.
And I just really wish that it would happen back here now.
Yeah.
As we could get past the hate and the fear that has been caused by all people in this country on all aspects of politics. But, you know, we need to get together and focus on what's best for America.
And I think we will, brother. At least I hope and pray we will. We're a resilient, you know, country. We always seem to come back from the depths when times are, you know, when times are tough and, you know, we're low. And I hope and pray that we do. Like you said, I think we'll get to
if
that
the Lord
point again.
Lord wills it, it will be.
Exactly. Exactly, brother. Where can people find your book, brother? Where can people find more about you?
Best place is markgeist.com. That is one of the best places. And also, you know, me and my wife had started a nonprofit. It's called Shadow Warriors Project, and it's at shadowwarriorsproject.org. Because we wanted to help private security contractors and their families not have to go through what I did, because my pay stopped the day I left Benghazi.
Mm-hmm.
I got paid for being in that country, and if I couldn't be there, I didn't get paid, so they stopped my pay. I had a workman's comp policy. My pay dropped with workman's comp. It dropped by 2/3. So we struggled a lot to get bills paid and things like that. And we had people that always helped out. And so what we wanted to do was pay that forward. And we started our program to do that. And it's morphed into more than I can even imagine is I was given a service dog by another group, another nonprofit called Special Operations Wounded Warriors, who blessed me with getting that dog and developed a relationship with Baden Canine, who is the ones who breed and trained her. Her name is Roan. I named her after Tyrone Woods.
That's cool. Yeah.
And, you know, we now have our own service dog program for private security contractors that have served that need it, and as well as veterans, because we wanted to help serve that community as well in a better way. And so we have a service dog program, and we also have a, what I call a canine therapy program, that deals with PTS that we put on as well.
Mark Ozgeist, thank you so much, brother, for being on the show. Your service to this great country and different capacities. God bless you, brother. Much success to you in the future. I'd love to have you back on the show sometime, brother. And if you ever need anything, you know where to reach me, man. Whatever I could do for you, just reach out, brother.
I would love that. And yeah, I'd love to get back on the show sometime in the future. We can talk more about the programs we're doing with Shadow Warriors.
I love that. I love that, brother. I'll be in touch. Take care.
God bless.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.